From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And 509 days after the disappearance of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, authorities are focused on airplane debris that washed up on Reunion Island in the Indian Ocean. Investigators are confident that the debris came from a wing of a Boeing 777, and MH370 was a 777. Now searchers are studying ocean currents to find out where this debris may have come from. Joining us from London is Dr. Eric Van Sabeel, a physical oceanographer and specialist in ocean currents at Imperial College London. Dr. Van Sabeel, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And if it is determined that this piece of airline debris is, in fact, from the Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, would it surprise you that it had been able to drift to Reunion Island?
Well, this kind of drift is totally consistent with the ocean modeling that we do. And in fact, some preliminary ocean circulation modeling that we've been doing now does tell us that, yes, you can get from the search area where most likely the plane has hit the water somewhere to Reunion Island in 17 months.
And would it tell you that there would be other debris that we're likely to see in the same place, or do the ocean currents just take things all over the place?
Well, the ocean currents in general are pretty deterministic, and we understand how they move. But on top of that, there's a lot of turbulence in the ocean, and it all mixes up a small piece of debris. So if at impact, the debris field would have been only a few hundred feet, by now, just because of the chaotic nature of the ocean and the turbulence of the ocean, that has grown into a debris field probably hundreds and hundreds of miles in diameter.
And would most of the debris from an airplane stay on the surface of the water and float around, or would a lot of it sink to the bottom and stay in one place?
Well, it's hard to say about especially this plane, because it also depends really on how it hit the water and how many pieces did it break up when it hit the water. But in general, we know that over time, pieces of debris get more waterlogged, they get more barnacles growing on them, and that really draws them down. It makes them less buoyant and buoyant. And from the research we've been doing about plastics in the ocean, for instance, we see that in a year, in 1.5 years, that plastic just sinks down to the bottom of the ocean. So I wouldn't be surprised if a large, really, really large fraction of all the debris now is already at the bottom of the ocean.
How difficult is it for something of that size? And just the image that we see of this looks like a wing flap, that's probably a pretty heavy thing. How easy is it for something like that to move such a far distance?
Everything gets carried by the currents, of course, and the currents can move anything that they want. I think the interesting thing is that it's been pretty bad weather over the last 1.5 years. And you may remember early on in the surge that there were all these hurricanes. These hurricanes, they create giant waves and really strong winds and turbulence. Normally, they break up a lot of things. And it just shows that airplanes are made to be extremely sturdy and to resist a lot of turbulence. That this piece of wing is still so intact, I think just shows that this has been a very strong piece of engineering.
How does this affect the search for the plane then? Because it sounds like what you're saying is this might have ended up on Reunion Island, but this doesn't tell us that a lot of the debris is going to end up in one place.
Absolutely, that's true. But I think there's some hope. So if we track back where something that ends up now on Reunion Island, where that was 17 months ago, we end up with a large area, a very, very large area, and we wouldn't be able to scour it at all. But we have other evidence. We still have the arc along which the search team is looking. And actually, it seems that this piece of evidence would make it more likely that the plane went down in the northern part of the arc rather than the southern part of the arc. So it might actually shift a little bit of the search zone, and it might give an opportunity to really rethink where the search is going on. The more interesting, the even more exciting possibility is when more pieces of debris are found. Because if we have other pieces of debris, we could track those back in time too, and in some way narrow the search area. It's a bit like the triangulation that your GPS on your phone does, where the more satellites it sees, the more GPS signals it gets, the more accurate it can actually locate where your phone is at that point. Now here we have only one piece of evidence, but if we start finding more of these, those will just add up and add up. At some point, maybe we would be able to really narrow down to a reasonably sized area that we could absolutely scour.
Searching for debris like this, of course, brings to mind all of the debris that left Japan after the tsunami there, and some of it ended up on the coastline of the United States.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we've learned a lot from that. And we've really used that to improve our models. Not only the debris, but also the radioactive materials. That's all gone into our better understanding of how ocean currents move stuff around.
That's Dr. Eric Van Sibeel, a physical oceanographer and specialist in ocean currents at Imperial College London. Dr. Van Sibeel, thank you for joining us.
No worries.
In Portland, Oregon this morning, Coast Guard officials addressed local kayakers below the St. John's Bridge and 13 Greenpeace activists suspended from the bridge high above the Willamette River.
You must immediately depart from this area. You are unwelcome.
For the second day, the activists successfully prevented the Shell Oil icebreaker, the Fenica, from leaving for the Arctic to begin exploratory drilling, which was given the green light by the Obama administration in April. Georgia Hursty is on her cell phone, suspended from that bridge. Georgia, are you there?
I'm here. Hi.
Hi. Well, first of all, you turned back the ship yesterday. It appears that the ship has turned back today. What was that moment like?
Well, it was pretty incredible. The ship came under the drawbridge just to the north of us and was steaming straight toward the climbers. We descended quite a bit lower than our camps. It was accompanied by a few tugboats and a number of police boats and Coast Guard boats. And we were in radio communications with the Fenica and made clear that their current course was a dangerous one and they were putting people's lives at risk. And eventually they stopped dead in the water. And then after some time, turned the ship around and went back through the drawbridge and now is no longer in sight.
Well, you were in radio communication with people on the Fenica. What were they saying to you?
The first time that we talked to them over the radio to make sure that we were following all the safety precautions of letting them know that they were on a collision course with the activists and that the activists had no intention of moving, they confirmed that they were stopped in the water and we're no longer on a collision course.
When this all started, we are hearing accounts of local kayaktivists, you know, people who were putting their kayaks in the water, who weren't even aware that you were going to rappel over. And then early Wednesday morning, you guys did, and people on the ground were even surprised to see you. It's sort of, you know, what does that feel like to do that in that moment?
It was a really beautiful moment, and we all felt very privileged to be able to, when we came off the bridge, there was, as you said, already lots of local movement, and there has continued to be lots of local work, and so we deployed, and there was already a vigil and kayaktivists in the water and lanterns, and so it was really inspiring and beautiful to be a part of that moment.
For the people on the ground, it must have been like, you know, Superman and Superwoman suddenly coming in, Batman, Spider-Man, something like that. But as you well know, it's completely illegal what you're doing. The Coast Guard was yelling that up to you the entire time. What are your thoughts about the consequences you might face?
Well, the thing is, the perspective that I've tried to have, both with the consequences and with the discomforts of hanging off the side of a bridge for multiple days, is that neither of those things are as destructive or as uncomfortable or as bad as the discomfort and destruction that will be caused if Shell will have to continue on this path of drilling in the Arctic.
Yeah, but you know what the Shell people say. They say that they are exploring, that they're doing it as safely as possible, and they're doing it to meet a demand. I mean, Georgia, maybe the people you should be protesting are the people who are using fossil fuels.
Unfortunately, we have a current system that's based on exploitation and based on, you know, corporate greed and corporate influence. So, you know, just like you don't blame the victim in the cases of abuse, in this case, I think it's the same where, you know, the people who are responsible aren't the people that are using the product. It's the companies that are creating a system where that's the thing that's available and most affordable. And this isn't a partisan issue. Shell knows what it's doing. It knows the consequences of drilling in the Arctic. Obama's own scientists have said if they find oil, there's a 75% chance of a spill. Global scientists have also said that the oil in the Arctic needs to stay in the ground in order to prevent catastrophic climate change. And so that it's really not a question of debate. And I think by trying to play it back to the people who use the product is really an unfortunate way to kind of take the spotlight off the real issue, which is corporate greed and influence in our politics and making decisions that are not only destructive for the world, but destructive for communities throughout it as well.
Because you use fossil fuels, and I'm imagining what you're saying is if all this money was put into researching and developing and promoting non-fossil fuels, other sources of energy, you'd have more options.
That's right.
Yeah. What's the importance of keeping just one ship from turning around?
I think that this direct action with this particular ship, the Seneca, that the Shell rigs that are there right now can't actually begin drilling for oil until a mission-critical piece of equipment, which is the capping stack that's on board the Seneca, arrives. So by blocking the Seneca, we're effectively stopping Shell from drilling in the Arctic. So every moment that we stop this ship from leaving is another moment that the Arctic is safe from drilling. And hopefully it's long enough to at least get through this season without them drilling in it.
That's Georgia Hursty, a Greenpeace activist currently suspended from the St. John's Bridge in Portland, Oregon, keeping a Shell icebreaker from leaving that harbor. Georgia, thank you.
Thank you so much.
This week, the UN said 19,000 people have recently fled the Dominican Republic for neighboring Haiti because of deportation threats. Some fleeing include children born in the DR, two Haitian migrants who've had their citizenship revoked. There have been protests in cities like Miami and Boston of the Dominican Republic's treatment of the darker-skinned Haitians. Some Dominicans in the U.S., like the writer Juno Diaz, have been speaking out as well, which pegged them as traitors to their fellow countrymen. But this week, activists are pausing to commemorate the day U.S. Marines invaded Haiti a century ago and the 19-year occupation that followed. You might be saying, the what? But that occupation has ties to what's going on today. Some call it the forgotten occupation. Haitians, including Robert Faton, have not forgotten. He's a professor of government and foreign affairs at the University of Virginia and has written about his country's history. Professor Faton, welcome.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
1915, 100 years ago, why did the U.S. invade Haiti?
Well, the immediate pretext for the invasion was the brutal killing of President Sam. But there were many other more fundamental reasons why the United States occupied Haiti. As you know, there was the Monroe Doctrine. At the end of the 19th century, the United States became one of the major industrial powers. And I think at that point, the U.S. wanted to fulfill its Monroe Doctrine, and it looked at the Caribbean in particular as a zone that would become the so-called American Mediterranean. And there were financial reasons associated with that desire. So the occupation started actually a little bit earlier in some ways, because in October of 1914, the U.S. Marines took over the Haitian Central Bank and took the gold reserves of Haiti and sent them back to Citibank. And that was part of a struggle for hegemony in the Caribbean between the United States, the German, the French, the British. And the United States thought that the Caribbean actually should be, to put it bluntly, its own backyard.
And there was resistance, fierce resistance, from Haitians who did not feel that way. Edwidge Dandicott, the wonderful writer, writes about her grandfather's memories of being one of those insurgents, they were called bandits, who tried to resist the Marines. It was a pretty brutal occupation.
Yeah, it was quite brutal. There was guerrilla resistance against the United States, and it was led by a fellow by the name of Charlemagne Peralt, who was considered as a Haitian hero. He was killed, however, and there are pictures of Charlemagne Peralt which were taken by the United States and dropped by planes over Haiti, and actually that increased the resistance. The picture is a very famous one because he looks like a crucified individual.
Now they pinned him to a door.
Exactly. And the resistance ended by the early 1920s, and several thousand Haitians were killed in the process, and over 15,000 people were jailed because of that resistance. Mm-hmm. The resistance, however, did not stop after the assassination of Peralt. It continued, and actually in 1929 there was a massacre of peasants, and that contributed to a reassessment on the part of the United States in terms of its policies and the occupation, and eventually that led to the formation of a commission, the Forbes Commission, which recommended that the U.S. should exit.
Well, U.S. troops did officially pull out of Haiti in 1934, although the U.S. was involved in Haiti's finances until 1947, and also occupied the Dominican Republic.
Yes, the U.S. occupied the Dominican Republic from 1916 to 1924, and it had significant consequences for both countries. The U.S. created a system whereby very cheap Haitian labor was exported to the Dominican Republic and to Cuba, because in both countries you had major U.S. Plantations, in particular sugar plantations, and Haitians would go there and work, and in return, the Haitian government would be getting a tax. So that was a system of forced labor, if you wish, that benefited the Haitian central government and during the occupation, basically the U.S.
Well, this also brings us to some of today's issues, because as you said, when the U.S. occupied the Dominican Republic, thousands of Haitians were brought over to do dirty work. And these are the ancestors of the Haitians who are now being told they have to go home.
Yes, and this is one of the major problems between the Dominican Republic and Haiti. There's been significant deportations, and in the last few weeks, that has accelerated. Something like 20,000 Haitians were forced to exit the country. Haitian labor in the Dominican Republic is a rather complicated phenomenon. It started, obviously, with the American occupation, but it has been exacerbated lately because the Dominican Republic has had more economic development than Haiti. So poor Haitians, in particular peasants, have been going to the Dominican Republic in order to get some jobs. And in return, the Dominican Republic uses that labor, which ultra-cheap labor, for the construction industry and for the tourist industry.
Well, look, I mean, obviously, we're hearing negative after negative results of the occupation of both Haiti and the Dominican Republic for the Haitian people. But what about those who would say, look, before the U.S. invasion 100 years ago, the Haitian population had bloody coup after bloody coup. There were no coups during the U.S. occupation. The Americans did build some roads and bridges. They collected taxes. How is the occupation thought of, though, by Haitians?
Well, it's a very vexing issue for Haitians. Any country that has been occupied would obviously feel quite angry and humiliated by that occupation. And Haitians felt humiliated, and at the same time, they were quite proud that there was resistance. The issue of the contribution of the American occupation is a very good question. But it was an occupation where there was no coup, but there was no coup because there was an imposed silence on the part of the occupiers. When Haitians tried to resist, they were immediately put down. It was a period of pacification, and it was, as we said, a very brutal pacification, and it was also a very racist pacification. The U.S., when they got to Haiti, were part of, a white supremacist order at the time. And it is very clear that U.S. policymakers, from President Wilson to Foreign Secretary Bryan, had very racist views of Haitians as incompetent, inferior, essentially savages. And not surprisingly, that led to significant tensions.
Edwidge Dandicott has a great quote. I will be gentle with it, but it's from then-Secretary of State William Jennings Bryan, who, in speaking of Haitians, said, think of it, the N-word, speaking French, because it was unimaginable to them. That kind of reflects the view you were just describing. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Professor Robert Faton of the University of Virginia about an anniversary that's being commemorated in Haiti this week, 100 years since the start of a 19-year occupation by U.S. troops. So, Professor, what is that anniversary like in Haiti?
Well, it's bittersweet because in Haiti, you had some meetings to remember the occupation. But Haiti in 2015 is basically an occupied country. The United Nations has a peacekeeping force. Our elections are basically controlled by foreign powers. And economically, we really have a situation of utter dependence. So we are still, to some extent, an occupied country without the brutality, if you wish, of the first occupation. But nonetheless, many Haitians feel that the country has yet to recover its full sovereignty.
Well, so are you tying it to the American occupation or to what some Americans would tie it to, which is corrupt leaders, vicious natural catastrophe that Haiti's born? They would point to that.
Oh, absolutely. The Haitian ruling groups are very corrupt. That corruption, however, is not uniquely Haitian. Actually, during the occupation, one of the major American economic advisors, a fellow by the name of William Cumberland, was known to have stolen a lot of money. And the name Cumberland has become, in Creole, a word that means that you're going to steal. So it's nothing new. It's Haitian, but it is not particularly or uniquely Haitian. Granted, the ruling groups in Haiti have been predatory and corruption is a real problem in the country, but it is not, I would argue, the key issue. Plenty of countries are corrupt and yet they are not so dependent. And at the same time, they've seen some significant improvement in the livelihood of their population.
Well, you say it's because of a century of a feeling of being an occupied country, born out of having been an occupied country. Does it surprise you that most Americans, if you asked, I bet wouldn't know that the U.S. occupied Haiti for 19 years?
Well, I'm not surprised because there is a certain ignorance about the past. It's not just in the United States, but also in Haiti. Many people forget the past, and the problem with that is that there is a need to remember those events in order to change the course, if you wish, of the present.
That's Robert Faton, a professor in the University of Virginia's Political Science Department, also author of Haiti, Trapped in the Outer Periphery. He's been speaking to us about the 100th anniversary of the U.S. occupation of Haiti. Professor, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And by the way, he mentioned the Monroe Doctrine. It called for the U.S. to respond if Europeans colonized a country. The U.S. thought the French and Germans were going to in Haiti, hence the U.S. occupation. Fascinating piece of history. You're listening to Here and Now.
Congress is getting ready to go on a 5-week summer recess without finishing some important business. The future of the Export-Import Bank is in question after the House approved a short-term highway bill yesterday without a provision to reauthorize the bank. Joining us from Washington for more is Marilyn Gwak, senior business editor at NPR. And Marilyn, first, remind us what this bank does.
Well, this isn't the kind of bank where you have your checking account. This is actually a federal agency. It's been around for decades. Its roots go all the way back to the Great Depression. And here's the problem it tries to solve. When businesses move into a foreign market, they have a tough time sometimes because they can't get their new customers to get proper financing to do a big deal. So the Export-Import Bank uses the full faith and credit of the United States to stand behind these loans. And the loan guarantees make it possible for foreign customers to get financing. They might buy a U.S.-made airplane, maybe a big power plant. That, the supporters say, helps exports. It helps U.S. jobs. The bank has pretty tough standards for getting this help, and they say that over time, over the last 2 decades, for example, they've generated $7 billion more than it costs to operate it. So the bank supporters say it's a good deal for taxpayers, it's a good deal for businesses.
But the fate of the bank has been tied to the highway funding bill, and as that debate has played out, we've seen a divide within the Republican Party over the Export-Import Bank. What are they fighting over?
Yeah, it's really a tough battle because the Tea Party conservatives, that wing of the Republican Party, says that an Export-Import Bank is really, in effect, corporate welfare. They say that it picks winners and losers. The federal government backs your loans for some people, but maybe they don't for others. So some people get an unfair advantage. This is really a philosophical objection. The opponents say government should not be providing financial tools for some corporations. That's the job of the private sector.
But we spoke with a lumber exporter in Arkansas this morning who said that if Congress doesn't figure this out, he would lose his loan guarantee, which would be a big risk for his company. What else have you heard from the business world?
Well, you talked to the Chamber of Commerce, the Business Roundtable. They're huge supporters of this. And, Jeremy, I might add, so are unions. They want those jobs. So some of the biggest companies are really pushing for this. Boeing's chairman yesterday said that the company might actually move some key operations overseas if Congress doesn't go along with this bank. General Electric has been saying the same kind of stuff. They argue that other governments in other parts of the world, that they not only support their companies, they actually subsidize them. So Americans would be at a disadvantage in the global marketplace if our government didn't also try to help businesses. But, you know, those opponents say, wait a minute, the United States should be different. We don't want to be like other countries. Their argument is that our strength comes from having the free market decide things, not having government pick winners and losers.
And the bank's charter expired on June 30th, but it still does have enough cash to keep operating through September 30th. So they've got a little more time to figure this out.
Right. They've got to come back in September and really take this one on. President Obama's firmly behind it. Nearly all the Democrats are. Most, Republicans are pro-business, so they're for it. But it's really complicated because, as you mentioned, it's now been attached to the highway bill.
Right.
And you're saying, wait a minute, that makes no sense. Well, it's Congress, and they do what they want.
It doesn't always make too much sense.
It doesn't always make sense. So that's where it's at right now. They're divided.
Marilyn G. Wax, Senior Business Editor at NPR. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says it is going to help Zimbabwe in its investigation of an American dentist's killing of a lion in Zimbabwe. Walter Palmer killed that popular 13-year-old male known as Cecil. Two Zimbabwean guides accused of luring the lion out of the Hwange Wildlife Reserve were released on bail as an investigation into their actions continues. According to the U.S. Embassy in Harare, there is so far no formal extradition request for Palmer, who is thought to be in the United States. The country's safari organization is also speaking out today, calling the use of lures unethical, even in cases where hunting is legal. The killing has led to international outrage, but it's especially upsetting for Dr. David McDonald, an Oxford University researcher who spent years studying Cecil's pride. McDonald is director of the university's conservation unit, and he's with us from Oxford. Professor, welcome.
Hello.
And tell us what you were studying exactly at the National Park in Zimbabwe.
Oh, this is such an interesting story. And you have to understand it in the context of lion conservation across Africa, where, as your listeners may know, there is a crisis in lion conservation. A few years ago, people estimated there was perhaps only 30,000 lions surviving in Africa now. We think the number is substantially less, and we have to find out what are the causes, the threats to them, and how can we mitigate them. And it is precisely those questions that myself and my colleague Dr. Andy Loveridge have devoted 20 years to researching in Hwange National Park on the west of Zimbabwe. So we are satellite tracking lions. We're recording every detail of their births, deaths, and marriages to understand the science of their behavior and the behavior of the local communities to identify the risks they face and use science to find solutions to their conservation.
And the lion that was killed, Cecil, was the dominant male in this pride. What were you learning from him?
Well, we've satellite tracked now the better part of 200 male lions, and Cecil becomes part of that pattern. So he was an extremely interesting lion. He, together with another member of his coalition, had monopolized a pride. We first collared him in 2008. So off and on since that time, at hourly intervals, using the satellite tracking device, we've been able to follow his movements. One of the things that's really interesting about lion society is it's very complicated. And so we have ascertained that what happens if a lion is killed, and of course this can happen naturally or legally, or as is apparently the case now, illegally. But if a lion is killed, the law of lion society is such that it means that the male brotherhood or coalition is weakened, in come some new males, they may well kill the remaining males of the original coalition,
right,
and usurp them, and then the natural course of events in lion society is that they would kill the cubs. So an important discovery we have made, and this has had big influence already in lion conservation, is that if people think about the death of one male lion, they should have in mind the risk that it has a cascade of effects, a perturbation in lion society that leads to the deaths of several other males. And this has been one of our results. And of course, it is now a risk in terms of the apparently, allegedly illegal death of Cecil. That could be the sort of cascade, the reverberation that flows from his death.
And are any of the males that are likely to die as a result of the death of Cecil males that you've been tracking?
Oh, yes. your viewers should understand the depth of our study. As I say, myself and Andy Loveridge have been doing this for 20 years now. We probably know more about these lions than is known about almost any other population in the world, and this is one of the biggest conservation efforts for lions that there has been. So we know, for example, that there was another male lion in the Pride. We called him Jericho, as it happens, and he may be able to hold the line. So, you know, the sort of perturbation I've described to you of killing may not happen, but it just depends now on the sociology of these lions. And I think the important point to get across in this interview is just how important lion conservation is, and just how important it is that it is based on sound knowledge, not only about biology, but about the lives of the people who live in the same vicinity of the lions. Because while we're talking now about trophy hunting, a big problem for lions and for people is when they leave the park, they may get involved in depredation on domestic stock, cattle, sheep and goats and so forth. So a big part of our work is working with local communities to find out how people in the 21st century can better live with lions and live alongside them so that both biodiversity can be conserved, but human well-being and livelihoods can also be developed. And perhaps I could say to you that there's been a lot of attention recently on, can any good come from the demise of poor Cecil? And I think the answer is yes. Not only can we learn a certain amount from it, but thanks to a talk show in the States, a chap called Jimmy Kimmel suggested people could support our project and support the work we do by making donations. And amazingly, overnight, our website has been inundated with people from North America saying they want to help us, for example, buy new satellite tracking devices or new vehicles for the project, or most importantly, to help us in training some of the wonderful young Zimbabwean biologists that we are training as conservation biologists and even looking for scholarships to bring them to Oxford to train. So some good can come from this, and I'm so inspired and so grateful to the upwelling of feeling in the world community, which I interpret as an enthusiasm for the value of lions, the value of big carnivores, the value of wildlife, wild places, and biodiversity in general.
Still, as you say, obviously a tragedy, the death of Cecil. Just give me finally your thoughts. When you saw that a hunter had gone and killed this lion, legally or illegally, in this case it was illegal, as you say, but either way, how do you feel about people going and trying to kill lions in Africa?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because I speak to you as a human who's decided to dedicate his life to wildlife and as a scientist who's dedicated to understanding these things. As a human, it wasn't many months ago that together with Andy Loveridge, my colleague in all this, we were watching Cecil moving out of the national park towards a hunting concession. And as I watched him and thought about him and was in awe of his magnificence, I longed for him to turn round and back to safety. And on that occasion, he did. So when I heard about his death now, of course, I was appalled and saddened. The fact that his death was brought about apparently illegally is, of course, completely reprehensible and abhorrent, and I was deeply saddened by that. But as I say, while that sadness is real, if the reaction can lead to us doing more and better work as a result of the appeal, that will be at least some fitting memorial for Cecil.
But what do you think about people who go out and try to kill lions? Do you understand that mentality?
Oh, you see, I have to tell you that modern conservation is extraordinarily complicated. It's not only about biology, it's about economics, politics, governance, regulation. It's about human behavior and animal behavior. So I professionally do not express a view on the rights and wrongs of activities which society regards as legal. In this case, we're talking about an illegal activity. However, what I do professionally is try and uncover facts that can inform people's opinion opinion on what the consequences of actions are, whereupon they can judge what should be done by society. So I offer you no view on legal hunting. I could tell you lots of facts about its consequences. I offer you a strong view on illegal hunting, which I think is completely reprehensible. And we are working closely with the excellent Zimbabwe National Parks Authority, who are diligently, as is their way, prosecuting this case against people who appear to have broken the law. And I think the full force of the law should be brought to bear on that.
That's Dr. David McDonald, the director of the Wildlife Conservation Unit in Oxford's Department of Zoology. He had been tracking Cecil, the lion that was killed in Zimbabwe. Dr. McDonald, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Earlier this week, Teamsters organizers announced they'll hold an election to unionize workers at Google Express. The employees in question work for Adecco. That's a firm that specializes in temporary workers and helps run Google Express, which handles same-day and overnight delivery of goods from retailers like Costco and PetSmart. A union representative says workers have complained about safety and that they have to sign on for 2 years, after which they have to find a new job. Google says it supports the workers' right to decide whether to unionize in this latest effort to unionize service workers who keep Silicon Valley's sprawling tech campuses running. Beth Willon from Here and Now contributor KQED reports.
Walking onto the large Facebook campus in Menlo Park, California is like being inside a Swiss clock. Clean, precise, organized. Day in, day out, groundskeepers, shuttle drivers, cafeteria workers, and janitors keep this campus ticking. In May, Facebook announced that contractors who do business with the social media site and have more than 25 employees must provide them with improved wages and benefits if they work a substantial number of hours. Facebook spokeswoman Lori Goler says the wage hike was given a lot of thought.
The minimum is $15 an hour, 15 days of paid time off a year, and a $4,000 new child benefit for both men and women.
There's been a domino effect since a union-backed campaign calling itself Silicon Valley Rising started leaning hard on tech companies to improve the wages of the lowest-paid workers. Activists are holding demonstrations outside of tech companies and contractors' offices. So was Facebook's pay increase prompted by recent moves at Google giving shuttle bus drivers wage increases and Apple bringing security guards onto its payroll?
We've really been working on it for a while, and it was not, you know, it sort of came from us and from within and our thinking about what's important and what's important to us and to our business and our community.
It also comes against a backdrop of national organizing for better wages for service employees. At a rally outside of a contractor's office in San Jose, City Councilman Ash Kalra says he sees a trend in tech companies bringing jobs in-house or hiring responsible contractors.
There's no excuse in this valley to contract with companies that aren't treating their employees well. No excuse.
But many companies are still under fire for the treatment of the service workers on their campuses. Case in point, Intel in Santa Clara changed cafeteria vendors in November. The new contractor didn't retain the 70 employees who worked under the old manager. Sarah McDermott of Unite Here Local 19, representing those workers, says Intel is responsible because it could legally have protected those workers.
When a company is changing contractors, Intel has the power to say, yes, we'll give you this contract, but we want you to hire the current workforce.
An Intel spokesman said by email it's not the company's policy to discuss suppliers and declined an interview. South Bay Labor Council Executive Director Ben Field says competition among vendors bidding for jobs is the culprit.
Part of the problem is that there is a race to the bottom among contractors for service sector work in high tech. And high tech companies can stop that from happening.
Until they stop it, the labor movement is pushing unionization. In February, shuttle bus drivers for Yahoo, Apple, Genentech, eBay, and Zynga voted to join the Teamsters. Drivers for Google did not. But that very next month, the company gave drivers pay raises and better benefits. Was that a way to keep them from unionizing? Google spokeswoman Wendy Pauley says no, that workers have a right to organize.
And in this case, we were being competitive with the wages and benefits they were being offered at the other companies in the Bay Area.
Companies like Google, Facebook, and Apple are clearly beginning to change. Russell Hancock, president of a consortium of business and civic leaders, says faced with critical public opinion, they don't have much choice.
They're being bludgeoned on these issues, and I don't think anybody enjoys that. I think they genuinely want to be a positive force.
Moving forward, Hancock expects newer sharing economy companies to be more open to increasing wages, improving benefits, and bringing service workers onto their payrolls or sharing responsibilities for contracted workers. It's no coincidence the Silicon Valley Rising Labor Movement was launched at Our Lady of Guadalupe Church in East San Jose. It's the same place Cesar Chavez first mobilized farm workers back in the 1960s. He would drive a bus to the fields and bring the workers back to the church to talk about voting and unionizing. Longtime Silicon Valley labor supporter Bob Brownstein says there are symbolic parallels.
You know, the grape strike wasn't just about grapes. It was about the plight of agricultural workers. The struggles of security guards and cafeteria workers and shuttle drivers is not just about them. It's about a much, much larger low-wage sector that's trapped in Silicon Valley.
Brownstein is urging the tech companies to come to the table about the wage gap, now $250,000 between top and bottom earners. For Here and Now, I'm Beth Willon in San Jose.